Please be seated. The third case for oral argument this morning is Robert M. Mercer, appellant versus the South Dakota Attorney General, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Mercer representing himself. And for the Attorney General's office, we have Mr. Jeffrey Hallam, Assistant Attorney General. As with the last oral argument, I think both you gentlemen are in the courtroom. Justice Wilbur is having some allergy issues. She will listen to the oral arguments and fully participate. So with that, Mr. Mercer, you have 20 minutes and you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. The reason I'm here today is I've been seeking the death investigation records regarding the death of Richard Benda. And I'll go to the end of this and say that the real crux, the real issue here is the lack of a standard for when the exemption should apply and those records could be made available and how they could be made available. State law, through a two-step process, does make them available in code. The Attorney General and I had reached an agreement, which in retrospect we should not have. Back when I originally requested these, my request was made before the death certificate was issued. And what has happened since then is a series of events that have led us to have a greater understanding of what this case is really about and how far-reaching it is in terms of Richard Benda's death. And then secondly, it exposed the lack of a standard for when these records might be made available. And it further exposed a fundamental problem in our state law. And that is, our state law shields the decisions made in a case of suicide, how that judgment is reached, that a death, a violent death, is a suicide versus a homicide or some other form of death. The law does not appear to give easy access to the death investigation records. In other words, how did the prosecutor or the attorney general reach the decision that it was a suicide? And what reasons were used and what facts were used? We know almost absolutely nothing about where Richard Benda was found and what they found and what led them to the decision that was reached. And the death certificate in itself raises a major question where it involves the use of a stick, allegedly to fire the shotgun that was the source or believed to be the source of the wound that killed Benda. The other point I would make is this. I think the circuit judge brought forth an excellent case that could become the standard, which was the Vincent Foster decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court. And I just don't think the circuit judge went far enough or had an incomplete consideration of that case. That case found that certain photographs, certain records in the death of Vincent Foster should not be released to a requester because they violated family privacy. And what was not done in the Benda case, to my knowledge, I don't think the record, the report, was ever analyzed, whether it be at the hearing examiner level, where I was rejected, or at the circuit court level, where I was rejected. It was never analyzed to see whether redaction could be used to take care of the privacy concerns and yet still allow the public interest to be met. There's no question that Richard Bendel was an important public figure. I mean, he's been in the news, unfortunately, now, ever since October 22nd, 23rd, when his body was found and reporters began to report on it. In the course of my seeking the death investigation records, we've learned a couple of things. It was not until we were already at the circuit court level and our briefs had been submitted that the Attorney General went before a legislative committee and told the legislative committee in an open public meeting, and I believe it's on the internet, that he was, A, he had prepared an arrest warrant for Richard Bendel, and B, was preparing to take Richard Bendel before a grand jury, or take the case of Richard Bendel to a grand jury for his alleged theft of $500,000 from our state government of public funds. And in addition, he also was pursuing Bendel on some double billing of travel vouchers for 3 airline tickets. So we were far along before we truly understood the magnitude of where Bendel stood in this situation. Secondly, it was not until fall of 2014, roughly a year after Benda's death, that we understood that the person whom Bendel had cooperated with on this entire EB-5 secret program, Yoak Bolin, was actually a very important state witness in a civil trial brought against the Board of Regents, state of South Dakota, regarding operation of the EB-5 program. So on one hand, we have the Attorney General seeking prosecution of one of the partners, if you will, in this, one of the 2 contract signers in this matter, and their key witness was the other contract signer. And when I say contract, Bendel, when he was Secretary of Tourism and State Development in 2009 during the Rounds administration, signed a contract with Yoak Bolin for Yoak Bolin's private company, which Bolin had formed in early 2008, while he was still a state employee for the Board of Regents at Northern State. Bendel, in 2009, signed a contract with Bolin, giving Bolin's company the authority to manage the secret EB-5 program for state government. And that they were the two. They each used an attorney, and so that's one of the reasons I think it's important to try to get to what happened at Benda's death. Bendel died he died within about a week of when he was scheduled to, or when he would have, when his case would have gone before the grand jury that the Attorney General had scheduled. That's at circuit court level. We don't know his state of mind. We don't know much about any of that. Now, let me walk back to the beginning of this. In November of 2013, I let the Attorney General know by email that I would be seeking these death records. And
if I could ask you a question, Mr. Mercer, are you wanting to look at his entire investigatory file or a limited portion of it, or what exactly do you want to inspect?
What I want to inspect is what was found at the scene and what led to the decision that it was a suicide versus some other violent act. What was found was his body with a shotgun wound to his abdomen, a shotgun, and then evidently this stick. How all that fits together, I don't know.
Well, Mr. Mercer, on that, are you contesting that there is an exemption or an exception to the public meeting rules for police investigative materials? Is that what you're...
Yes.
You're not contesting that, so you're contesting the discretion used by the Attorney General in releasing it?
Yes. What I've laid out in my brief are the statutes which I believe lead to these records being publicly available. That was not contested by the Attorney General. He agreed to that, which is what I was leading up to next. In November, then, when I filed the request, he called me the next day and caught me off guard, frankly, telephone call late in the afternoon, and said, I can do this, but here's what we're going to have to do. And I'm caught off guard. I should have paid closer attention. I thought he said that he needed to get approval of a family member. Okay. When I received, so I thought, well, you can put whatever condition you want on yourself if you want to comply with this. Secondly, he then provided the contract, if you will, to me. I read through it. The part where it outlined what each of us had to do, it did not say that I had to get the authority of a family member. However, and this is the point they later hung their hat on, later it says that before he will release the records, I have to provide that approval, a copy of that approval. And at the time, I should have thought it through. I thought what he was saying was, I mean, I thought from our conversation that he was going to get it, and I thought, well, that's odd that I have to give him back his own copy. All right, so that's how I went forward with it. I signed it. Several weeks later, we talk. Turns out they understood to mean I had to get the approval. I had signed this. So I thought, well, I'm going to attempt to hold up my end of it. This is where the whole thing turned, what I'm about to describe next. First of all, I had to find out, okay, who do you consider to be a family member? Whose approval will you accept? Took a little bit. They got that. I asked, what kind of form do you want? Took a little bit. Jeff provided that. So then I went forward, and I contacted the former wife. Benda was divorced, and she said no. They also said they would accept the fellow who Benda lived with, his housemate, former fellow employee. I contacted him. His response was, the former wife doesn't want me to grant this, so I'm not going to. I'm going to consent to her wishes. I felt stuck, and I let the Attorney General know. Well, then what happens next was that the former wife sends me an email unsolicited, and I believe it also went to the Attorney General, that said she would seek injunctive relief to stop the release of the record. And so there was suddenly this third-party approval coming into play in a much broader way. What then happened was Attorney General Jackley and I had a telephone conversation. I can remember where I was standing and what day it was and everything. At any rate, we had a telephone conversation, and I asked, how do we deal with that? The Attorney General's advice to me was, you shouldn't fight her. You shouldn't fight her on that. And I said, no, the injunction won't be against me. It's going to be against you releasing the record. And he then said, well, I'm not going to fight her. So even though we had signed this agreement, faulty as it might be, and I'll come back to why I think it's faulty, but even though we had signed this, now suddenly this agreement wasn't going to stand from his side of it. And that's when I pulled back and refiled my request completely and just went at it as the law allows access to these records. Redaction is identified in state law as the method to allow the records to be released. I went to the hearing examiner level and was rejected. Went to the circuit court level and was rejected. Now, at the circuit court level, however, Judge Trandall brought forth the Vincent Foster case, which U.S. Supreme Court decision. And what the court said there, as I mentioned, is that family privacy in that instance outweighed the release of photographs of Foster's body. And the court, however, also said this does not apply to any other or to future cases necessarily. It's like saying we can't use one door in this room. There are three other ways to come in and leave this room. And the court explicitly spent several long paragraphs pointing that out. And so when I received that, I thought, well, there is the solution. There is the standard we're missing. And that is why I suggested in my brief to your court that the relief here very well could be, whether it's in Bendis' case or in any future case regarding a suicide finding, that the circuit judge could review the case, could review the file, and decide what was personal, what should not be released publicly, and then release the rest of it. Now,
so in this case, the circuit judge has never seen the file either?
To my knowledge, no.
Okay.
To my knowledge, no. Nor did I request that it be presented. I mean, I'll acknowledge that.
Let me take you back to the beginning. Yeah. You started the argument with saying that the crux of the case is the lack of a standard.
That's correct.
And that the problem is in the state law. And
right.
I think we all, or it doesn't appear to me to be any dispute, that these statutes totally exempt criminal investigations. So how are we to fix the state law? It seems to me that's the job for third floor, to change the statute.
I understand your point.
To provide this discretion that you'd like to, like something similar to what was allowed in the Vincent case. If that's going to happen, doesn't that have to happen with the legislature instead of us?
No, it's already in law. And if you examine my brief, it will show you those statutes specifically. One statute sets it up, the other statute delivers it. And it is there.
But what about the beginning statute?
What's that?
What about the beginning statute, subsection 5? I mean, it totally seems to exempt criminal investigation information.
It does.
So how do you get past that?
But later, but elsewhere in code, there is another portion of code that sets up the exemption for that. And you'll need to examine my brief to see those citations. But that is true. And that's not been the point. The Attorney General didn't fight me on that point, nor has the hearing examiner, nor the circuit judge. They've all seen it. And they've evidently not disagreed with it, because no one just threw it out because of that. In fact, the Attorney General argued that he had the right to fashion his own solution to this, based on what I refer to as it's a case about Hughes County, but it had to do with the mansion back in 1992 approximately. In that case, which came to this court, the circuit judge at that time, because it dealt with three juveniles, or four juveniles, including the victim, in that case, the circuit judge decided he would let reporters into the courtroom, even though it was a juvenile proceeding, on the condition that the reporters agree ahead of time that they would not identify the identity, address, etc., identifying information of the juveniles involved. No other reporter in South Dakota took that compromise. I did. I went in there. I watched what transpired. I thought it was far more important to see the application of justice in that particular case, which was a very high-profile case. And that became the foundation for what the Attorney General said he was attempting to do in his original offer to me, that he would release it provided I could get family permission. Because what I would just say to you on your point specifically is that the Attorney General would not have, if he could have just claimed a blanket exemption, he would have in this matter. But he did not. He instead tried to fashion a remedy that, for whatever seemed to suit both sides. Where I think it was faulty is this. That remedy said only I would get the records. And I don't think, and looking back on it, I think that was just wrong. I mean, a public record is a public record. And so the release needed to be beyond just to Bob Mercer. And there were some other side issues attached to that. But the exemption is in the law. It's there. And redaction is the one method identified in state law. Short of a total release, redaction is the one method. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mercer. You'll be given 10 minutes for rebuttal after Mr. Hallam. Okay? Mr. Hallam, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Justices, Mr. Mercer. Mr. Mercer's argument is an argument to be presented to the South Dakota legislature. That is under what circumstances would a death investigation that did not result in a criminal action constitute a public record to be made available for the public? The current state of the law is the legislature has determined in SDCL 1-27-1.5 sub 5 that an investigation conducted by law enforcement performing law enforcement duties is exempt from the public disclosure laws. And if you look at the statutory constructions on it, all of the presumptions of mandatory public disclosure are conditioned upon one of the statutory exceptions not applying. This court in Argus Leader versus Hagen clearly held that where there is an exemption from the mandatory public disclosure provisions, that the custodian of the records had the legal authority to deny a public records request. Now, if you look at those statutory provisions, and Mr. Mercer has agreed that in his initial November 26 request, that 127.1.5 sub 5 applied and it exempted the records that he was requesting from public disclosure.
So you don't see either one of his suggestions of redaction or an in-camera inspection by the circuit court as appropriate in this case based on the statutes?
Yes, Your Honor, because we view the redaction statute, which is 127.10, as applying where a record is subject to public disclosure. And how we reach that is the last sentence that in that statute said a redaction under this section is considered a partial denial of a public records request. So if it's a partial denial, that means is that it relates to a public record. Here we're not talking about public records. So for Mr. Mercer's argument to have legal merit, you would have had to start out with a document that would be a public record. Then the custodian of the record would say there are certain items that would be an unwarranted invasion of privacy that we're going to redact. And the redaction statute clearly allows that. And then that process then would be, if it was contested, that a court might review and make that determination. But even in that scenario, because that's equivalent of what happened in National Archives versus Favish. In that case, Favish made an open records request, not from the law enforcement agency when they conducted the investigations, but from the archives where these records go later on. And the question there was, could the family independently raise privacy interests? And the court said, yes, they can under the federal rules. And they also, under those circumstances, said that the party requesting had to have some rational basis to overcome the privacy interest where you're talking about improper official investigation. What it said is at a minimum, they had to produce evidence that would warrant a belief by a reasonable person that the alleged government impropriety might have occurred. Mr. Mercer suggests that there was some governmental impropriety, just like Favish did in the case of Mr. Foster, but there's no evidence to support it. What has now available to the public was After the DCI conducted the investigation, the Attorney General issued a press release. Within that press release, it talked about what the forensic pathologist found. That was a self-inflicted wound. And it also said that the law enforcement concluded that there was no evidence of foul play. The death certificate that was issued indicated that death occurred by a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the abdomen.
All right, Mr. Helen, I have one concern in that apparently the Attorney General determined that he had the authority and the discretion to release a portion of these records. But did he exercise the authority of his office appropriately when he turned it over to a decision of someone else on whether or not to release these records? Isn't that what he's elected to do? And can you delegate that authority to someone who's not the official responsible for making that decision?
Well, the Attorney General, as Mr. Mercer indicated in his request, made the determination. He said that there's privacy interests here and I'm not going to release it. I mean, so that was his determination on it. But he said, because of the public importance, if you can convince the people that have the privacy interests that they're willing to release the information, I won't second guess that and I'll allow a limited release. So he exercised discretion by saying no, and Mr. Mercer indicated that. And then he said, but if the family wants to, for lack of better words, waive any privacy interests they may have, that will be okay. That's what prosecutors do all the time, dealing with victims. But so it's not unusual. It's not a delegation to a private party. What it is if Mr. Mercer can convince the private party to give him a release, the Attorney General will go forward. That's a proper exercise of discretion.
A problem then with what Mr. Mercer's talking about is no standard. I mean, you've got the Attorney General basically saying, well, I'm not going to release it unless the family consents. No standard there. The family's got to consent. So if Mr. Mercer goes to the family, the answer is no. And whatever their reasons, we don't know. But, I mean, doesn't that give the arbitrary decision to the family for whatever reasons they don't want to release it when the request is made to the Attorney General?
The question is whether or not there is legitimate privacy interests and whether that is a proper exercise of discretion. The Attorney General determined that privacy interests was an issue. And so he determined that the only way to release that would be as if the family agreed. That is a legitimate exercise of discretion. I mean, Favish says that these individuals would have an independent right, if the Attorney General agreed to release it, to come in and stop the release on privacy grounds. So,
in that case, the Favish case, they dealt with specific pieces of information. In this case, it's just, no, we're not going to release anything.
What's in a death investigation file that is not different than what was in the Foster-Favish one? That they were opposing release of information on it, and what it was the photos and information surrounding the investigation. What is Mr. Mercer asking for? The information surrounding the investigation. How did it occur? The photos. The stick. How did they reach the conclusions? What else isn't there? Those are the events surrounding the death that a family would have a legitimate privacy interest in. Favish says that. Our statutes are under the redaction are similar to the federal FOIA ones. So that was a legitimate exercise of discretion. And this court has held what a standard is for an abuse of discretion. This court has said that discretion exercised to an end or purpose not justified by and clearly against reason and evidence is abuse of discretion. Has that occurred here? The obvious answer is no. I mean, the Attorney General made his decision. That was a proper exercise. Now, he could have said, well, I'm going to talk to the family, but if the family doesn't consent, I'm going to say no. But that's or unless the family says yes, I'm going to say no. It's a distinction without a difference to have Mr. Mercer go attempt. Because Mr. Mercer wouldn't have been satisfied with the Attorney General's answer that if he said the family said no. I mean, a lot of this is Mr. Mercer hasn't been satisfied with any response the Attorney General gave. He hasn't just not satisfied with it. And He wants more. The question is whether he's legally entitled to more. And that answer under current South Dakota law is no. It would take the legislature to change. Because right now what he's asking the court to do is basically turn this into a civil discovery issue where we file something in camera without any basis for it. So the legislature hasn't set standards. What do we do when law enforcement is totally exempted? Even under the redaction statute, it's an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. How do you get around an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy? You get the consent. So, I mean, however you define the statutes, even if you applied 127.1.10, as Mr. Mercer is arguing, we end up with the same place. The death investigation file of the photos and the events surrounding the tragic death of Mr. Benda are not public records, and they wouldn't be released. So, but you do not get there under current state law. Now, Your Honor, if for some reason you say that the Attorney General doesn't have discretion, Mr. Mercer still loses, because then there is no discretion to release any records. So that doesn't help Mr. Mercer out. All that means is that the Attorney General was mistaken when he determined he had some discretion. And the discretion here was exercised because of the extraordinary circumstances on it. It's pretty much no good deed goes unpunished. If we were here today and the Attorney General just said no, we wouldn't be here. The thing is the Attorney General attempted to do something that still took in consideration the privacy interests of the family. And now what it's been saying is that's not good enough. Well, what is good enough? Darn if I know. I don't know if the legislature could establish such a standard. And then what that would be doing is turning the court into basically a discovery issue on every criminal investigation. Because there's a lot of cases where there's no criminal charges filed. So we go to the judge every time. And then how does law enforcement conduct their investigations, knowing that what's behind it, the people that are being talked to, that somehow this may be publicly disclosed to the press or the public? You know, that would be darn hard to do an investigation where at the time you don't know if there's been a crime committed or not. You go down a lot of rabbit trails. You know, a number of the justices here at one time were prosecutors. They understand what law enforcement needs to do for a criminal investigation. So you're turning the whole process on its head. That's why even under the Freedom of Information Act, there's an absolute discretion for criminal records on it. So they need to be protected. There is good reason. And when law enforcement conducts an investigation, our legislature has determined that it is exempt even if it's not resulting in a criminal charge. 127.1.5 sub 5 is broader than criminal. It would cover a coroner's records. It would cover a pathologist looking at things if they were doing it under official action as part of an investigation. It was intended to allow investigations to go forward without public disclosure. If that is to change, that is something that the legislature must do. That's something that Mr. Mercer needs to make his case in front of the legislature. Now, we're going to resist that because we think that that would invade the ability for law enforcement to properly conduct. But ultimately, that's going to be an issue for the legislature, whether our stance or Mr. Mercer's stance prevails, because public disclosure is wholly by statute. And there's no common law, there's no constitutional law. This is not like access to the courts. So under these circumstances on it, Mr. Mercer may have been mistaken, but the Attorney General has always been consistent. One was his investigative records by law enforcement are not subject to public disclosure. He has limited discretion in certain circumstances. I mean, we do give certain information out, but that's different than full-blown public records. And in this case, because of the extreme circumstances, he said, even though I'm not going to release it personally because of privacy interests, if the family agrees, if you can convince them, I'll acquiesce. That is a proper exercise of discretion under these circumstances. So in conclusion, the hearing officer got it right. The Attorney General had the authority to deny the request, and that denial should be upheld. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hill. Mr. Mercer, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, I think the facts speak to where the Attorney General actually stood when all of this began. He was planning to release the information because he was under tremendous criticism and under tremendous questioning on some blog sites and in the general public on what really happened at that farm on October 20th. He agreed to this in an attempt, I believe, to protect his reputation. And I think that cuts to the flaw in all of this, and that is the public has no opportunity to review how a prosecutor or an attorney general reaches a decision on a death, on whether it was a homicide or a suicide. And we have seen, I checked these statistics just the other morning. I looked at them again today. Back when Mark Burnett's last 3 years as Attorney General, the suicides reported by the State Department of Health were 95, 94, and 108. The number of suicides in 2010 through 2012, the first 3 years of the Attorney General's time, were more than 100 in total, more than that. All I'm getting at is that there are more than 100 suicides a year, and that we are simply expected to believe law enforcement that they were a suicide. Now, I have no reason to doubt the Attorney General in his finding of a suicide in the Benda case. A reason I wanted to find out more about how Benda died and who was involved and the circumstances surrounding it is that we've had to work almost extensively or exclusively from public records in this EB-5 matter and in the Benda matter and the Bolin matter. The program was secretly operated for years by our state government. It was shut down secretly by our state government in 2013, approximately a month before Benda died. We had this entire operation that took place outside of the public's view. Now, I will return to some of Jeff's points. I'm not here trying to find out every criminal investigation. All right. But what we have in a suicide is an unusual set of circumstances. We have someone who has died, and the prosecution has determined that that person died by his or her own hand rather than by someone else. The victim can't come forward. The witnesses, there are no witnesses typically, can't come forward and say, no, that wasn't what happened. We have to accept that on blind faith. And if we have a shooting by a law enforcement officer, we get a report on that. If we have an accident on the highway where there's a fatality, we get a report on that. Beyond the simple death certificate. If we have a homicide and that case goes to court, we can see in court what happened. In this case, the victim, the deceased, we don't know whether the deceased truly was the victim of his own hand or some other force. And that, I think, is the inherent flaw in the protection being provided in state law. The Favish case, the Supreme Court notes in that case, in that decision, that there were multiple other investigation reports, including by members of Congress. In this case, we have nothing. And I understand his reliance and claiming that these are off limits. But if you look at the way the statutes have been constructed by the legislature, there are two specific statutes that tie together. They are listed in my brief, and they provide the opportunity for the exemption to be used. And the only choices in our state law are saying no, saying yes, or using redaction, as which Mr. Hallam correctly notes is a partial denial. I am asking to protect the personal privacy interest that he has stressed, that redaction be the method to achieve that balance. And that's all I'm seeking here. Otherwise, we have no standard. We have an opening in the law that each attorney general or each county prosecutor can use her or his own discretion and judgment on, an arbitrary decision. And that's what I'm trying to address here by asking for this court to find a standard. And I believe that standard was correctly identified by Circuit Judge Trandall, and that it needs to go one step farther and use that balancing, which is what the court did in the Favish case. Do you have any further questions?
Any questions from the bench? I guess not.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
I appreciate it.
The court will be in recess until our oral arguments tomorrow at 10 o'clock, correct, Julie?
Yes.
Okay. Recess.